We're so lucky to have such a diversity of wildlife in our state. And really, with every subtle change in the weather and season, there are fascinating differences in the activities of our wildlife. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. There's something to watch for and marvel at in every season, it seems. And no surprise, late spring and early summer are really busy times in nature. David Drake is a wildlife specialist with the UW Extension and an associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. David, always great to have you with us.
Well, Judith, thank you very much. It's a pleasant surprise to see you
yes,
today.
Yes, Larry is home with a sick child, so I'm happy to step in. Can't fill those shoes, but happy to step in. And Jamie Knack is a wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Jamie, welcome back.
Hey, thanks. Great to be here, and another beautiful day.
It is a beautiful day, and we were just talking about how this spring, it seems like, at least for plants, has been really great, which is wonderful, and bad for biting insects, which is not so great, but we'll talk a little more about that later. I want to let people know that they can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also leave a question or comment on our Facebook page. That's the Larry Mueller Show. And there are already some great photos up there for people to enjoy. Well, Jamie, last time you and David were on, we talked a bit about the new Keeping Wildlife Wild Wisconsin initiative. And you're on that committee. Tell us a little bit what it's about.
Yeah, so it's an outreach campaign that the Department of Natural Resources has taken the lead on. It involves some internal partners for them, both conservation wardens, wildlife health biologists, customer service representatives are on the team, as well as some external partners, myself from the Department of Forest and Wildlife at UW-Madison, and also some licensed wildlife rehabilitators. We've been getting together and coming up with various both products, print products or media related, whether it's radio, or we've had a number of members on the committee doing morning show interviews live from various urban areas, but really trying to get this message out on keeping wildlife wild. So the best place for a baby animal to be is in the wild, is to be kept in the wild. And inherently, people, as they come across baby animals, sometimes think they need help when many of the times they really don't. So we're trying to get some important information about animal behavior, ecology, what is normal, and in what cases is an animal truly injured or needs some assistance, in which case we would put them in contact with a wildlife rehabilitator.
I wonder if in part it isn't because human babies are very vulnerable
and always
when
with
they're
their
newborn.
Mother.
Right.
They're with their mother. So I think that's one of the biggest things is when you see a new or a young baby animal that is alone, the reaction is something happened to the mother and I need to help. And again, 9 times out of 10, that is not the case. Mother is nearby, but you know, she's just not right next to the animal. And it's a life strategy for that animal.
Well, and David, I think most of us have probably seen Bambi, and, you know, you see a fawn on its own and you think, oh, the mother has been killed or is not able to take care of them. I want to tell people that we have a lovely photo up on the Facebook page and on WPR.org as part of today's program note. Our news director, Michael Leland, took a really lovely photo of a fawn hiding in the grass, all curled up. That's a very typical way that you would run into a fawn all by itself and in the grass. David, what's going on there?
Yep, absolutely. And if you go to the, Larry's Facebook page, you'll see the picture of the fawn, and it's got white spots on it. And so that indicates it's a relatively newborn fawn, and those white spots help to camouflage it so it blends into the surrounding. And
so it looks like dappled light.
Absolutely. Yep. And if you are kind of in a wooded area like you see in this picture here, or kind of a grassy area where you sometimes find fawns as well, they blend in very, very well. Mm-hmm. And another strategy that they have, especially early in life, is they have either no scent or little scent. And so predators that are carnivores, you know, eat other animals, that the primary way they find their food, if they don't see them, is they smell them. And so having that that coloration of the white spots combined with no scent gives the fawn, when it's left alone, when the mom goes out to feed, it gives the fawn this outstanding way to protect itself. Even though it does seem like a vulnerable little animal, maybe even, you know, a week old, it seems vulnerable. But nature is pretty amazing in how they it works to protect the animals, and it's you know, for these animals, they need to perpetuate the species, and so it doesn't benefit them in any way if you have high fawn mortality, for example.
So let's go back to that scent issue, because that's really fascinating. So at what age do they develop the scent that a deer is supposed to have?
I think, what is it, about maybe 2 to 4 weeks, something like that?
It's probably, I mean, if you think about it from an evolution standpoint, the fawn is going to not have scent early on while it's incapable of outrunning its prey, its predators. So I would suspect then at, you know, at some point it does, you know, start to have that scent.
Yeah, but it is you know, the first couple of weeks for sure, it's you know, little to no scent, right?
Yep. So that, for me, brings up the question, how does the mother find the fawn again? Does she remember where she left it?
Because she remembers.
Because I'm guessing, maybe I'm wrong, but if there's not a scent for predators to track the fawn with, there's not a scent for the mother to track the fawn with either.
Yeah, well, keep in mind, so that, you know, where the animals live is their home range. Mm-hmm. And so within that home range, I mean, it's very similar to us living in our neighborhood. And we know our neighbors, and we know, for example, you know, maybe which neighbor we've loaned the ladder to. And when we're looking for the ladder, we know we have to go there. So there's some spatial memory.
Okay. But that also brings up the issue that it would be detrimental to move that fawn, because
it would.
The mom's going to come back and say, I could have sworn I left her here.
That's right. But, you know, the other thing is fawns will bleat. And so that, you know, if they, something's going on, they'll bleat, and the mom will hear that and come running as well. And the mom can bleat, and the fawn can come to the mom as well.
Wow. Kind of like a mom yelling out the back door, time for dinner.
That's right.
Time to come in.
Come home. We actually had a related question on Facebook from Elaine. She asked if you could clarify whether people handling fawns need to be careful to avoid getting human scent on them by using gloves or not handling them close to their bodies, perhaps wiping them down with grasses before releasing them back in the wild. Is that the current practice?
So, Elaine, this question really gives me a chance to highlight one of the outreach print documents that's available on the DNR's website. If you go to the DNR's website and you do a keyword search for keep wildlife wild, there are a number of documents, and we can talk about some of the others later, but one of them is a dichotomous key on what I found a fawn, now what?
Okay.
Or I found a baby bird. Or I found a mammal. So there are three of them.
Oh, great.
And it allows the public to go to that and work through that dichotomous key based on that situation. So not knowing the situation here, about the only time the public would really want to get involved to the point of moving a fawn is if it was in a hazardous situation. So, and yet a situation where mom is likely nearby. So maybe it's in a school play yard. Hmm. And you pick up the fawn and you move it to the other side of the fence where the kids can't be by it. But you have all, you know, everything points to the likelihood that mom is still in the area.
Okay.
A situation where a fawn is on the highway and you see that mom has been killed. That's a situation where you might pick it up to secure it, but you're going to call a wildlife rehabilitator. And again, that directory is on the website. So, the only cases that I can think of where you would actually want to handle a fawn is one, to move it and get it to a rehabilitator if it is sick or injured, or in a case where its safety is of immediate concern and you need to intervene. In both of those cases, you're probably not going to worry so much about scent. As far as the state's protocol, you know, they have completed a multi-year study on fawn mortality to help with just population information for the deer herd. And in those cases, you know, they probably do wear gloves and try to basically minimize the amount of time that they're handling that animal. So, but the notion that a mother or a doe will not return to a fawn that has human scent is simply not not the case. And it's also not the case for baby birds, which is where most people hear it.
Right.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, with birds, most birds, an overwhelming majority of them, have no smell. They have a very poor sense of smell. Hmm. And so it's not that the mom bird smells the human scent on the chick. It's that that human scent is an indicator for the predators to come to the chick.
Oh, okay.
And so the predators kind of key in on that human scent. And that's why you try to minimize the scent attachment to
young. Interesting. So it's not affecting their relationship with their parents, but it could be a hazard in another way.
That's exactly right.
We are talking about Wisconsin wildlife with David Drake and Jamie Knack. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today. And you can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. You can also post a question or comment on our Facebook page, or send a question or comment by email. That's talk@WPR.org. Jason Butler, our on-air producer today, will get those to us. Well, let's go to the phones, and Daniel in Minong is up first. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. I came up north, west of Minong, mid-April. The winter was brutal. I saw only a few yearlings, and the does I witnessed did not appear to be pregnant, even when the time for birth approached. Would does abort their fetuses due to the stress of the severe winter as a survival mechanism?
All right. Thanks for that call. That's a really interesting question. David?
Yeah. Hi, Daniel. So, yes, does will sometimes abort fetus, and it's primarily due to lack of nutritional health. And so the doe doesn't have enough food or doesn't have enough nutritional resources to where she's maybe nutritionally stressed, and it's a decision between her or the fetus. And so she will abort the fetus sometimes if the body can't handle it. And so it is an unfortunate part of it, but that is, again, is another life strategy. It's better to abort the fetus and let the mom live so that she can go on and get rebred in another year and have additional does.
And Daniel's really in an area, as he mentioned, where we saw a very, very severe winter. Mm-hmm. So the other thing that can happen is instead of seeing many twin fawns, you may see more singletons. Mm-hmm. And that is also the state, the Department of Natural Resources does summer deer observations, so they can get an estimate of fawn to doe ratios. They track those from year to year so that they can get an idea of that winter severity. And I know reports coming in now, there are a number of fawns on the landscape, of course. Mm-hmm. End of May, early June is usually the kind of peak for fawn drop. And in the Central Forest, there's been lots of positive data coming back that there's been lots of twins and even some triplets. So things look good there, but certainly in that northwest corner of the state, it might be a little bleak.
Mm-hmm. So that, again, going back to kind of the evolution and that drive to keep the species going, it makes sense that a mother who could continue to reproduce every year, the body, that would be the priority.
Yep, that's exactly right.
And is it at this time of year when the new fawns are dropping that the yearlings are kind of getting pushed out on their own?
Yes, that can also happen more in the fall, come rut. That's when the yearlings will get pushed off so that doe can be bred again.
Okay. And speaking of other baby animals that we might see this time of year, WPR host Joy Cardine spotted this little bunny coming out from under her deck. It's up on our Facebook page. She named him Baby Bun Bun and a tiny little bunny. But I know that one of the things that the Keep Wildlife Wild initiative is hoping people will do is keep an eye on their household pets.
Yes, definitely. If you do know of a warren or a rabbit den in the lawn, oftentimes it is in a grassy area, sometimes a mowed area. And that's one of the more common animals that's reported, and people will take in that nest of bunnies thinking they've been abandoned. But that doe rabbit, she just nurses in the morning and early evening, and then she's pretty much out of sight to keep predators away from that area. An idea there or a tip there, if you think it may potentially be abandoned or you just, really think you should be seeing that doe and you haven't, is to take some grasses or some small twigs and crisscross them over that nest and then check back in the morning and see if they've been disturbed. Mm-hmm. But yes, my parents have had lots of rabbit nests, and we often bring our dogs to visit on the weekends, and we usually figure out where they are and make sure we keep the dogs on leashes because, they can really make quick work of a nest. So,
how long are baby bunnies in that nest?
Maybe a week or so? Two weeks?
2 to 3 weeks, and then they're out kind of exploring, and they can have some pretty fun antics as they're jumping over each other and goofing around. But, probably a good 2 to 3 weeks before their eyes open and they're starting to explore outside of that nest.
Great. We are talking about Wisconsin wildlife with David Drake and Jamie Knack. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about Wisconsin's incredible wildlife with Jamie Knack and David Drake. And going back, let's talk a little bit more about baby animals because, What's cuter than that, really? listener Judy Peterson had posted a wonderful photo to the Wisconsin Birding Facebook group, and I recommend anyone who enjoys birding or just enjoys looking at great photos, join that Facebook group. There are a lot of really great contributors. She gave us permission to post a photo, and it is one adult wood duck taking care of 22 ducklings at Stricker Pond in Madison. It's a really adorable photo. 22 little ducklings behind the adult and this whole wake of water going behind them. And people on the Facebook group were commenting, David, wow, that how could you sit on that many eggs? But it's probably not all that adults' babies.
Yep. So waterfowl will commonly accept or adopt other parents young. And mm-hmm. you'll see this with Canada geese a lot of times too, where something may happen to the adults and the young of that clutch will be adopted by another set of parents. And so that's what's happened here with the wood ducks. And
so is that a permanent adoption or is it more of a ducky daycare?
Well, it would be a permanent adoption until those ducks are old enough to go off on their own.
Okay.
And then as you can see from the picture here that those young are old enough that they can kind of fend for themselves. They are following the mom around right now. But, they can feed for themselves and kind of take care of themselves. And they're certainly mobile enough that mm-hmm. they can get out of the way of, some predators like maybe large fish or snapping yeah. turtles or some raptors or whatever the case might be.
It is really an adorable.
Yeah, it is neat.
Pretty neat.
Boy, talk about make way for ducklings.
I know.
That would be a yep. traffic tie up for hours probably.
That's right.
Well, we have Allie from Duluth on the line, so let's go there. Hi, Allie.
Hi. I was crying because I found some eggs in my yard. I was having a new boiler installed in the house, and I went outside to check the work, and it looked like the technicians had actually stepped on a clutch of eggs that were buried in the dirt. They were really large eggs. I'm familiar with duck eggs, and but I'm not familiar with how eggs are, where a duck might lay their eggs. I immediately thought that they were duck eggs, and I brought them inside and put them under a heat lamp because half of the eggs had been stepped on and were broken and gone. And then I did a little search, and it sounded more like they were probably snake eggs.
No.
And so I put them, I'm still not sure. I removed them and put them in a spot where the technicians could not step on them anymore and put them back in sort of a soiled area. But nothing has happened with them. It's been a few weeks. And I don't know quite what to do, what kind of eggs they are. And that's where we're at.
All right. Well, let's see what Dave and Jamie have to say.
Sure. Thanks for the question, Allie. Is she still
yeah.
online? She
mm-hmm.
is. Okay, Allie, I have two follow-up questions for you. How close to water are you?
Not that close to water. I am, I'm in Duluth, but I'm actually live in Minneapolis. There is, I live near Powderhorn Park, which is a large, a reasonably good-sized lake for the city. And so we're just a few blocks from there.
Okay.
But,
and the soil that you found the eggs in, was it recently disturbed? Was it kind of a loose, unpacked soil?
It was right up against the house, and it was right underneath the exhaust for the boiler, which is warm.
Right.
It was an unusual thing.
So Allie, my hunch is that, we have about 20 species of snakes, and about half of those species give live birth and half lay eggs. However, my hunch is that these are eggs from turtles, and just out of commonality, they're more likely to be either snapping turtle or painted turtle. And you can probably do some looking on the internet, both at painted turtles and snapping turtles, to get an idea of the size of the eggs. But in either case, again, turtles probably being more likely, the adult does not defend that nest. So she digs a hole, she lays the eggs, covers them back up with the loose soil, and then leaves the area. So in terms of what you should do, I would relocate them relatively nearby in some, maybe a foot or two deep with some loose, dark soil so it heats up with the sun, and just leave them be. And you're probably looking at, depending on the species, maybe 45 to 90 days for incubation.
All right. Well, thanks for that. And Allie, we'd love to have an update from you if anything ends up hatching. Thanks for that call. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And a listener without Facebook emailed a photo in with the following comment. I haven't been able to ID this bird I saw in Onalaska, Wisconsin the other day and cannot find it online or in any of my bird books. I wanted to see if anyone knew what it was. So, David, I know you were flipping through a bird book there. Do you have a guess for Matt? And let's describe the bird. How would you describe that bird?
Well, I was just trying to look at the size of it. And it looks like it's, I don't know, maybe 6 inches or so?
Yeah, maybe like large pigeon size, maybe?
Large pigeon size, and it's got a kind of a black curved line along its neck. And I was trying to see if it's, I don't know if we can blow that picture up or not.
I don't think so, but, actually.
Yeah, orange feet, orange bill.
Yeah. And is it something on the side or on the wings?
Some barring on the side of the body, some barring on the feathers. And
it's standing on like a rocky... something.
Yeah, so it looks, I don't know if it doesn't look like it has webbed feet, but we were thinking maybe a chuck or partridge.
Oh,
which is a type of game bird that are typically set out for, you know, off of hunting preserves.
So it might have been either released or just got out of somewhere.
Yeah, they might be near a preserve that one has been out, or also they can be used for dog training purposes. So.
Okay.
Yeah, yep. That's what it looks like.
That's your guess.
It's not a super common bird. I mean, it is on hunting preserves, but it's not. You don't see it out.
So a chucker pheasant,
you said. So it's Hungarian. They sometimes call them Hungarian.
Those are different. Yeah, Hungarian partridge would be a different animal.
Different than chucker. Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for that photo. And Sharon also posted a photo on Facebook of a fawn. She says, because of the outreach from Wisconsin wildlife specialists in the media recently, I knew what to do. I stopped and looked quickly if there was a doe that might have been hit by a car. And I gave it a little nudge, and it hopped up into the grass in the ditch by the road. I looked to be sure it hadn't landed in water and left. So she came across a little doe or a little fawn and did exactly the right thing. Well, thanks for that. Ruth Ann also took a lovely photo of a doe and a very cute little fawn in her backyard near St. Germain, Wisconsin. So certainly a lot of fawns around.
And seeing that picture on the road of the fawn makes me remember to mention to listeners that if you do see a doe across the road, to be aware that this is the time of year where fawns are often behind and not as steady on their feet. So just like in the fall during hunting season and during the rut, you want to slow down if you see a deer, because there could very well be another one, and one that's maybe not so well adapted on its feet yet.
Again, using the human analogy, it's kind of like seeing an adult bike rider and making sure
and
there's
a little kid
in the burly or on their own bike behind. Well, let's go back to the phones, and Claire in Madison has a question. Hi, Claire.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm so glad you're doing this show today, because I have a big problem, and I hope your experts can help me. I have an infestation of raccoons in my garage, and I figured out where they got in last year, and I sealed that hole up. And lo and behold, this spring, I could hear them in there, and of course, they had their babies. So my questions are, is it safe to try and get rid of them now as far as the babies? Are the babies big enough to get out of the garage? My ideas were to use 4th of July smoke bombs in there to smoke them out. And then maybe turn a loud radio on. Would that keep them away? And, of course, seal up the new hole. And what can I do to keep them from coming back?
All right.
One of my neighbors has a pond, and I think that might be part of the attraction of the neighborhood.
Sure. Well, let's see what David has to say.
Claire, where in the garage are they? Are they up in the rafters, or are they kind of stuck behind some garbage cans? Or where exactly are you finding them?
I have heard them up in the rafters, but I have a feeling they've got the run of the garage, because I have not been using it. I've been afraid to disturb the babies, so they're probably all over.
And do you know for sure they're raccoons?
Yes.
Okay. So the best thing that the first thing you have to do is make sure that you seal up all the entrance and exit ways for them, so that once you get them out of there, they can't just return. So before you do anything with the raccoons, make sure you seal up all the ways that they could get into the garage, and that includes making sure your garage door is down when you're home or you're gone. And you don't leave the garage door up. You leave any access door and windows shut, and sealed tight so they can't get in and things like that. And then you can take a live trap, and you can bait that live trap with marshmallow, or you can put some strawberry jam or jelly or something like that on a piece of bread and put that in the trap. And you may have to trap multiple times because you may catch the mom first, and then you're going to relocate her outside the garage, and you're going to have to go back, and if there are young, you're going to have to catch them. Depending on how old the young are, if you go up there, you might be able to just catch them with either a net, like a long-pulled net, and you could just scoop them up if they're not terribly mobile and set them outside. Or you can maybe, if you've got a heavy-duty set of gloves, like welding gloves, you can just grab the raccoons, the young, and take them outside as well that way if you don't want to trap them. But raccoons certainly, you know, they can scratch and they can bite, and they can carry rabies, so you want to make sure you're very careful about that. And if you do trap the mom and you are able to capture the young, before you let the mom out of the trap, set the trap outside and then capture all the young and set them right next to the trap and then let the trap open, leave the trap open, let the mom go out so that she'll care for the young that way. But before you do anything else, I would seal up everything, and I would, if you're not comfortable doing it, I would maybe have somebody else pop their head up into the attic and just see kind of the lay of the land up there and make sure it is raccoons and see how many raccoons you might be dealing with and how old they are and things like that. And then that will dictate whether you're going to trap everything or you're going to trap perhaps the adult and try to capture the young in another manner.
So going back to Claire's suggestion of music or smoke bombs, Jamie, would that work?
I would say, you know, one thing to consider, you know, at least maybe to try is that mother raccoons will relocate their den if they're, you know, kind of harassed enough. So it's possible to put in some ammonia-soaked rags. You could try mothballs, which is naphthalene. Sometimes if it's a large enough area, that smell just kind of dissipates. But I've seen people or talked with folks that have had success in attic situations where they've used either the rags or a radio set to rock and roll, you know, loud music, and also leaving a big floodlight on for a couple of days, enough that it's annoyed the mother and she's relocated the entire family. So that may be something. I mean, what's the harm? Right. Your neighbors might think you're crazy and having a party in the garage, but it's at least worth a try for a day or two before you. But certainly trapping and overall excluding them out of the garage when things are done so this doesn't happen again is going to be really important.
But I would definitely not use the smoke bombs because is a fire hazard involved with that because you have to light them. And in addition, you know, with the smoke, you also may harm those animals up there. Right. So I would avoid the smoke bombs.
All right. Yep. Well, thanks for that call, Claire. And actually, Claire's question reminded me that we are now within the period, I believe, where bats are not allowed to be disturbed. David, do you want to remind us what that's about?
Yep. So unfortunately, white nose syndrome, which is this fungal disease that's attacked cave roosting hibernating bats, has been found in Wisconsin in Grant County in end of March. And so because of white nose syndrome, even before it was found in Wisconsin, it caused the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources to kind of reclassify our state resident bats as state threatened species. And so if you find bats in your attic or in buildings, and sometimes you'll have these maternal roosts of especially our big brown bat or little brown bats, that one way to get them out of there is that you seal all the openings up except for the last one, and then you use what's called a one-way excluding device. So when the bats go out for the evening to feed, they'll go out that excluding device and that one-way door, but they can't get back in. Well, from I think it's May 15th to the end of July, August 1st, that we've got bats that are reproducing. And if you exclude the mom and she can't get back in at the end of the night to get back to the pups to nurse the pups, you've essentially condemned the pups to death. And so unless there's a immediate health concern, for example, in a retirement home or nursing home or something like that, that you are not legally allowed without a permit from the DNR to exclude bats in residential situations or building situations between May 15th and August 1st.
Yeah. I could be wrong, but I was thinking it was June 1st. August
yeah, it
15th.
Might be June 1st. Yeah, somewhere there. But go to the DNR website. Yep. So it's the bulk of the summer months, and it does go until at least August 1st.
We are talking with David Drake and Jamie Knack. They are with the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. We always like when they join us to talk about Wisconsin's wildlife. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and you can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. And going back to, we talked earlier about how interesting it is that fawns don't have scent in the early part of their life. And Daniel posted on Facebook, fawns begin developing a scent as they wean onto grass. This happens rather quickly. They start nibbling on greens at 4 to 6 weeks. He says he's witnessed black bears hunting for fawns in open grassland. They observe the doe's reactions as they mill back and forth in a sort of graph pattern. If they see the doe become agitated, they know they're getting warmer. The bear will pounce or thump the ground and then stand still, hoping the fawn will hear it or its mother and panic. Once the fawn flushes, the bear almost always catches them. It's kind of brutal to witness, but also really amazing to see how tactical a bear can be.
Yeah, bears can be a pretty significant predator on deer, but it is, for the most part, in those early weeks of life where they are capable of short bursts of 30, 40 mm-hmm. mile an hour speeds that they can catch these fawns. But as they get older and more agile, typically a healthy deer will outrun a bear. So
so this 5-year deer study the DNR is doing, one of the things they're finding is that black bears are a pretty significant predator, mm-hmm. especially on fawns. But I've had my daughters out when they were trying to catch these fawns to radio collar them, and I will say that even young, that they're pretty quick, and they're not the easiest to catch all the time for humans or bears.
Wow, that's fascinating though, to watch, like he says, that tactical approach.
Right.
That would be fascinating to see. Thanks so much for sharing that, Daniel. And we are going to continue talking with David Drake and Jamie Knack after just a moment. Great to have you with us today as we talk about Wisconsin's wildlife with David Drake and Jamie Knack. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. And let's go back to the phones and Vivian in Eden. Hi, Vivian.
Hi.
Hi.
So I had this this nest of turkey eggs. Actually, it was last year that I had this nest of turkey eggs. And we couldn't find the mother. And, like, we didn't know where she went, but we took them in. We tried putting the turkey eggs under a heat lamp, and they never really hatched. And we weren't sure whether to, like, put them back because they had the scent of our hands on it or what.
All right. Jamie?
Great. Thanks for the call, and we'll use this as kind of a teachable moment. But as far as turkeys go, they do stay with their eggs. So we talked about the turtle earlier, where she lays her eggs and leaves. So in answering that caller's phone call about what to do, we can actually intervene and move those eggs to where the workers weren't working on our house and then leave them in the dirt and kind of leave them alone. They don't need us to really do any more than that. They wouldn't have done any more than themselves. But in the case of the turkey, the hen does need to sit on those eggs to incubate them. And the fact that she wasn't coming back, and she will take moments to go and feed herself. So just because you come across the nest doesn't mean that she might not be returning. But if you do go out there a number of times and you feel the eggs and they're cold, it's very likely that she abandoned. And if you didn't come across that nest quickly and, potentially do something, you really didn't stand a chance, which is why incubating didn't help the situation at all. On the plus side, I would have just left them and hope that she is, in fact, fine and healthy, that she just, for whatever reason, abandoned that nest. And she will often, early enough in the breeding season, those turkeys will re-nest, and they don't actually have to be bred again, but they can re-nest somewhere else. What we don't want to do, though, is take those eggs into our homes and try to incubate them. In fact, there are laws for captive wildlife where you have to have licenses, as you can imagine, to take wildlife from the public and care for them. What you do have is a grace period of 24 hours to take an injured or sick animal and get it to a wildlife rehabilitator. That's a question I would leave to the rehabilitator in the situation of an abandoned turkey nest, whether they would actually go through the you know, the process of incubating eggs, again, you'd really have to find out that they were abandoned. You'd have to figure it out very quickly once they've cooled down. It kind of stops that process. So in the case of abandoned bird eggs, just kind of leave them there, and something else will scavenge them and utilize those eggs for protein, and life goes on.
The only thing I'll add to that, Vivian, is with most bird species, that when they start laying the clutch, or that set of eggs, and turkeys, I think the average clutch size is roughly 6. So when they lay that first egg, they won't come back to the nest until they lay the second egg, and then the third egg, and the fourth egg. And as they get a whole clutch size, then they'll start to incubate. Because if they start to incubate that first egg, then the first egg hatches out, and then they've got that little young running around, and they may have still 5 or 6 days before the last one hatches out, and it's just too much. So they coordinate it in what's called synchronous hatching. And so it's not uncommon to find a nest of eggs with no mom there if the clutch is not complete. So one thing I might suggest is, if the eggs are still in that nest, is go and count how many are there. And if it's under 6 or so, she still may be completing that clutch, and she'll come back and eventually incubate that clutch.
Yep. Good point. Yeah, I assumed it was a really full nest of eggs, but yes, correct.
Oh, thanks for that call, Vivian. And actually, since you were just talking about wildlife rehabilitators, Jamie, there was a question from Jeff on Facebook. What is the process to become a wildlife rehabilitator?
Ooh, I don't know the specifics. There are, licensing and training that has to, steps that need to be taken. But I do know that you can explore that on the DNR's website. So if you go to their webpage, type in Keep Wildlife Wild. On the right-hand side, there is an Explore Wildlife Rehabilitation. Both the application license, exam, and study guide are there, and some other policies and so on and so forth. But I am not 100% sure on what that all entails, but I do know that the resources are there on the website.
And you may, if you have a wildlife rehabilitator in your local area, you might want to just get in contact with them and ask them what they had to go through as well to get licensed.
Yeah.
Great. It sounds like there's certainly a lot of work out there for those rehabilitators.
Yes.
So, well, one of the things that this time of year is so great for is bird watching, obviously. And it seems like the spring migration of warblers and such has pretty much wound down. But, David, what kind of statewide reports are we hearing?
So the migration is pretty much over. Dick Sisson, those are some of the last birds to come in, and they've started to show up now in south and central Wisconsin. So we've shifted from migration. Now the birds are shifting into nesting and brood rearing season. And so we've got a lot of birds there now. You're starting to see young fledglings coming out that are from the nest. And so it's been pretty good so far. I think, it's finally we got through that winter, and it's been a pretty nice spring, relatively dry and relatively warm. And so it should be a pretty good production year for birds.
Okay. Anything unusual about this year's migration?
No, not really. I think for a while we had, so the birds in the spring, they're not going to migrate unless we have southerly winds.
Right.
And so for the longest time, we were having a lot of winds out of any direction but the south. And so these birds were kind of stop-gapped or stopped down in the southern part of the United States. And finally, we got southerly winds, and we had just phenomenal birding there for, a couple of weeks.
Yeah,
it was just wonderful.
Middle of May was, really good for warblers.
Yeah, it was just awesome. So that's been pretty nice. And they've had some reports coming out of the DNR now that they've done some drumming surveys for ruffed grouse. And it looks like the ruffed grouse population is down 1% this year from what was last year, according to those drumming surveys, which is kind of an index about how many ruffed grouse are out there. And so they're trying to figure out grouse cycle every roughly 10 years. And so we're kind of getting toward that low point in the cycle. And so it could just be that 1% decline could be that we're getting near that low point relative to habitat loss or something like that. And then there was a lot of concern, as Jamie was pointing out earlier in the show, about the severity of the winter, especially on deer and turkey and things like that. And the DNR said that the spring turkey harvest was up 10% this year relative to last year. So perhaps some of those concerns about the severe winter being harsh on turkeys were unfounded, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And, the warblers get a lot of attention, especially in the spring, because since trees haven't leafed out yet, it's a lot easier to spot them.
Yep.
But I've really been appreciating seeing wonderful photos of waterfowl. They're really a fascinating group. Jamie, what are some of the waterfowl that we get to watch in Wisconsin?
Oh, well, we spent, our family went up to Horicon National Wildlife Refuge, which is, one of the wonderful places to go and look for waterfowl, but certainly going to have a couple different species of teal, blue wing and green wing, going to have shovelers, Red-headed ducks we saw, wood ducks, certainly mallards. Mm-hmm. What other ones am I missing, David?
Well, the,
and then all the divers, yeah, the mergansers, yep, and golden
the buffle heads,
eyes,
golden heads. Eyes, yep. Mm-hmm.
Another, you know, kind of prime birding areas over in Sheboygan or just on the lakeshore to mm-hmm. begin with.
Yep. Lots of gulls over
lots
there.
Lots of gulls, yep. Yep.
And then you'll get into some of the, like, old squaws and...
Yep. The divers, the
yep,
diving.
The scoters and mm-hmm. things like that, yeah.
Great. Well, let's go back to the phones and James in Milwaukee. Hi, James.
Hi.
Hi.
Good morning, Judith and guests. I think that your guests would agree with me that habitat loss is a very important issue when it comes to, you know, protecting birds and other wildlife species. Now, I would like to say that there's an area that I'm familiar with called Parnell Woods in North Sheboygan, in Sheboygan County, where there's a timber harvest planned, and they're going to open the canopy up by 30%. Now, the last... a three-minute point count that I have has seven bird species, and four of them are threatened species and need to have that canopy closed. And the threatened species are the red-shouldered hawk, Acadian flycatcher, hooded warbler, and cerulean warbler. So I'd just like to know, I mean, this is the Northern Kettle Moraine. It is owned by the DNR, and I'm just wondering why the DNR would allow that to happen. This also happens to be an area that's called Natural Area 1, which means it's pretty much in similar conditions to what it would have been in pre-European settlement times.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, James. And Jamie, you know, acknowledging that you're not with the DNR, but
yeah,
but
not
work,
with the DNR, can't
with
necessarily you know, address specifically why, you know, the harvest in light of what you're speaking up with some of the rare species. But I am familiar with that area. I grew up in the Sheboygan area, so I've been to that site. The reason the state would be doing a timber harvest outside of what, you know, the species are there is to regenerate the forest, which I think the bird diversity overall will, you know, spike after that harvest. So as forests mature, you are certainly going to favor more climax bird species, old growth, you know, habitat. But in harvesting it, it kind of, you know, opens it up to some of the early successional or mid-successional bird species as well. So you might see more diversity, but I really can't comment on, mm-hmm. you know, how they are managing that area for some of the more unusual or rare species. I would like to think that they are keeping some of that habitat in that older growth form to protect those species mm-hmm. that you specifically mentioned, but they're just managing for diversity of habitat instead of uniform habitat successional stages across the forest.
David, did you
yeah,
want to
and I think it's again, as Jamie said, we have no idea what the specific reason for that timber harvest is, mm-hmm. but timber harvest is not necessarily a bad thing. And as with any management activity, you have some species that are winners and some species that are losers, and unfortunately you can't do something that benefits everything. And
sure.
So maybe there's some reasons in there, and you know, as trees age, they start to get old, and there's commercial value to trees. Maybe they're saving it for the commercial value, or trying to keep that commercial value from those trees before they get so old that they start decaying. And they may be managing for some other species in addition to those four species you mentioned as well, James. So, yeah, if you're curious, one thing you can do is every county has a DNR biologist and forester, and find that DNR personnel and maybe go and ask them and have a conversation with them about what's going on.
And I wonder if sometimes there are also public hearings. It sounds like maybe it's further along
there's
in the process for this.
Most likely a master plan for that property, as there are. Those get reviewed on a cyclic basis. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, definitely stopping in at the service center and having a conversation.
Great. Thanks for that call, James. And John in Franksville is up next. Hi, John.
Hello. I'm pulling off to the side of the road right now.
Great. Thanks.
Well, I've only tuned in a little while ago, so I don't know if you've talked about any of this, but I really want to talk about squirrel behavior and mating behavior. We've had an ongoing issue with a squirrel trying to nest in the engine compartment of our RV when it's parked at my home, and this started over a year ago, and we managed to stay on top of it, cleared out, and got past the nesting time, and then took off with the RV. So last year was not a big issue. This year, however, we arrived home about from our winter vacations, and they promptly started to set up a nest in our engine compartment. It did quite a bit of damage, actually. That was taken care of. We managed to keep the nest out, the squirrel nest out, on a daily basis by going in, removing any nesting material, using various spray-on repellents. This sort of thing has not worked. But what the observation that I have is that we thought we were free and clear a couple weeks ago because we witnessed a squirrel taking little furry things and transferring it from a tree nest to another tree nest. Well, as of all of a sudden this last week, the nest started to be rebuilt daily, and between night before last, which no nest there, by 1 o'clock yesterday afternoon, I had a full nest with 5 babies in it.
Oh, wow. Well, let's find out from David and Jamie if what you're saying is pretty expected squirrel behavior.
Yep.
David?
So squirrels will have multiple nests around, and those squirrel nests are called dreys, D-R-E-Y's, D-R-E-Y. And they will commonly move the young from drey to drey. And nobody's exactly sure why that is, but the thought is that that they have ectoparasites in the nest, so mites and things like that. And as those ectoparasites start to get on the animals, it causes them to itch, and it can kind of drain some resources from the animals. And so they move them to get into a non-ectoparasite-type nest. So and it is a common behavior to move squirrel nests from time to time. As for your RV, squirrels are rodents, and rodents commonly will get into the engine compartment of automobiles and RVs and trucks and things like that. And as you mentioned, they can be extremely destructive because they start chewing on all the rubber hoses in there, and they can start chewing on the distributor cap and the wires, and they can actually cause your vehicle not to run because they'll do so much damage. So there's a couple of things you can do when your RV is parked, and one thing is to fill the engine compartment with naphthalene or either mothballs or naphthalene flakes and see if that odor will kind of keep the squirrels out of there. Or the other thing is, once you park your RV, perhaps take some chicken wire or some hardware cloth and adhere it to the side of your RV and then hold it down on the bottom with some cinder blocks or something like that. Essentially, don't allow access underneath that RV and inside the engine compartment to the squirrels while you're gone. And that should hopefully keep them out.
All right. Well, good luck with that, John. And how interesting to see the squirrels moving the babies from nest to nest.
That's pretty neat.
It really is amazing if you're paying even a little attention, how much you can notice and observe.
Yep.
Lots of activity out there. Let's go to Shirley in Park Falls. Hi, Shirley.
Hi. I have something that happened that I've never experienced before. I have 3 hummingbird feeders. And 2 nights ago, something drained them completely and knocked one down. Now, what would go inside a hummingbird feeder?
All right, David?
Well, I don't think anything went inside the hummingbird feeder, but I'm guessing it's a raccoon because it's sweet water and raccoons kind of like sweet things. And so they probably found it and either started sucking it out of there. Or I know we've got a hummingbird feeder that has a little kind of a rubber plug on the end, and that's how the portal where the hummingbirds kind of get the liquid. And so raccoons could easily remove that rubber plug and essentially drink it like soda pop if they wanted to. So I'm guessing that's what it is out there. And so a couple of things you can do is keep some bright lights on around that hummingbird feeder, possibly. Maybe take the hummingbird feeder down periodically, and so don't allow the raccoons to have access to it for a little bit. They'll find another place to go, or put the hummingbird feeder in a position where the raccoons can't access it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that call, Shirley. And going along with the feeder issue, we had an email from Jill in Amory. Is it usual that after the initial crazy feeding time as the birds return, for there to be a lull time at the feeder while the birds nest?
Yeah, not unusual. While the birds are nesting, they may also just be switching to more natural foods that are available. So early in the spring, not all the natural foods are on the landscape at that point, and they may have just switched to more preferred food sources that are naturally occurring. And certainly while the females, and in some cases the males, are incubating or tending to the fledglings, they may be less frequent at feeders. So, yeah, the frequency can certainly change.
And I've heard that, for instance, Baltimore Orioles, while they like the oranges and the grape jelly, when they're migrating back, that when they're nesting, they actually like mealworms. So that would go along with what what you were saying.
Yeah, they can switch their, for dietary reasons, you know, kind of switch their preferences.
Yeah.
In just a couple of minutes we have before the news, David, I wanted to go back to something you said, and it's something that Bill Volkert has mentioned on our birding shows also, that the birds coming back to Wisconsin come in an expected order.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
Well, it depends on how far they are. Their staging area for the winter sometimes it just takes them longer to get up here. So that's part of it. And typically the males will try to get up here before the females because they're trying to set up territory and defend that territory so that they can attract the females to their territory. Mm-hmm. And then there's also, you've got birds that some are faster flyers than others, and they can just travel faster like that. And so there's a combination of factors for that.
Okay. That's just fascinating. So you were saying, for instance, when you start seeing the dick thistles,
yep.
you know that that's kind
yep.
of the, they're bringing up their
yep.
rear on
yep.
migration.
Yep. And some yep. of the earliest migratory returners are, cedar waxwings and robins and red-winged blackbirds and sandhill cranes and things like that.
And it can be with, again, the food that's available.
Mm-hmm.
So those
yep,
species he just mentioned are ones that are consuming some of the berries that are left over from the winter. And,
okay. So they're not waiting for new growth.
Correct.
Or insects. A lot of them mm-hmm. are following insects, the insect migration and insect hatch up. And so that's the other thing that Jamie mentioned, the food.
Fascinating. And we have a lot more fascinating topics to cover with David Drake and Jamie Knack. They will be with us right up until 12:30. We're going to talk about the impact of black flies on loon nests up north. We're also going to get an update on the UW-Madison fox family and so much more. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. I hope you'll stay tuned. Many of us that live in Wisconsin count our amazing wildlife as one of our treasures. And whether you're new to wildlife watching or you've been doing it all your life, it's great to have people that know and care about our environment to talk with. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. I'm glad you could join us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jamie Knack is a wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Jamie, always great to have you with us.
Hey, it's great to be here.
And David Drake, great to have you too. David is a wildlife specialist with UW Extension and an associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. Thanks again for coming by, David.
Thank you for having us.
And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jason Butler, our on-air producer, will get those calls into us. And I'd also recommend taking a look at the Facebook page. There are lots of great photos up there, and also a link to an article that Wisconsin Public Radio's news department published on Monday, I think it was, that loons are abandoning their eggs due to black flies in northern Wisconsin. And Bob and Lac de Flambeau had a question about that, whether it's true. And David, you said it does seem sadly to be true.
Yes, unfortunately. And this is not an unusual occurrence. It happens a lot with whooping cranes, unfortunately, and the experimental population in Nisida. And essentially, the black flies get to be such a swarming population that they attack the eyes and some of the other mucous membranes of those birds, and they essentially drive the birds off the nest. And so they are abandoning the nest. And
wow.
They'll try to re-nest if they can, but it is, as a matter of fact, with the black flies and the whooping cranes, it's actually caused very little recruitment in some years because the black fly population is so just onerous.
Wow. So, Jamie, we think of black flies and other biting insects as real, what would we call them, banes of the existence of human populations, but
yeah.
it actually affects wildlife,
yeah,
too.
It certainly can. Bluebird in nest boxes can be victims of black flies, and actually lots of studies have been done on bluebirds and specific housing designs to help curtail some of the black fly issues there.
Are there other insects that have that kind of impact?
I mean, at this time of the year, I was just looking at a report just on an email list that I belong to, but horse flies, some of the biting flies, will impact deer. You'll see them maybe out in open fields more often than in the woods. So they'll maybe be more noticeable. And if you pay attention to them or look with binoculars or a spotting scope, you'll see that they're just twitching constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of insects can be problematic.
Yeah, and it's not just the swarming issue, but, you know, insects carry a lot of diseases as well. And so there's insects are a great vector for, you know, different diseases like West Nile and things like that. Yeah. And so they can cause some real strife for wildlife, for sure.
Well, let's go to Darren in Madison next. Hi, Darren.
Hi, thank you very much for having your show
on.
Sure. Thank you guys for coming in. I had two questions. We recently moved out onto a farmhouse south of Madison a ways, and first question was about chipmunks or ground squirrels. We've got lots and lots of chipmunks on the property, and I'm fine with it, except that I discovered there's an old shed that I use to store stuff, life jackets, and they have gone in and eaten all the rope out of one of the hammocks in the matter of about a week.
Wow.
And just chewed them up to pieces, and I'm, you know, apprehensive about my life jackets being in there, and I was just wondering if there are any good, you know, non-lethal methods of keeping the chipmunks away from some of my chewables out in a shed like
okay.
that.
So a non-lethal chipmunk repellent,
you know,
David?
Yeah, so chipmunks are real ubiquitous, you know, all over the place. And if you are interested in a non-lethal solution, the best thing is, if you can, in that shed or that barn, is find either a steel garbage can, and you can put your life jackets and things like that in there, some kind of a rodent-proof container, or if you have the ability, if you've got a closet or some kind of a smaller room in that shed, maybe anything you don't want chewed upon, is put it in that shed, and then just make sure that it's inaccessible to chipmunks and other animals. You know, you've got mice and things like that. So, you know, where the bottom of the door meets the threshold, just make sure that there's not a large enough gap that animals can get under there. And if there is, you're going to have to put some kind of a shield there or some kind of a material so they can't get in. But that's probably your easiest thing, is just store stuff in either rodent-proof containers or in a section of that shed that rodents can't get to.
And, Darren, you also had another question?
Yeah, we're lucky enough to have a pair of bluebirds on the property that were already starting to try to nest in a birdhouse there. And since they've been in there, we've added a lot of feeders, hummingbird feeders, other types of bird feeders. And there are some red-winged blackbirds that have come in, and they're pretty voracious. They're blackbirds and some grackles on the feeders that are near the house where the bluebirds were. And it seems like there's a lot of the red-winged blackbirds, and that the bluebirds have left that area. And I was just wondering, is there anything we can do to discourage the red-winged blackbirds and grackles from kind of overwhelming the area where the bluebirds have been trying to nest?
All right. David?
Well, you can. There are some different kind of noise-making devices that you can try. If you are in an area where you're not going to disturb your neighbors, and it's legal for you to use those noise-making devices in the township you live. But of course, if you use the noise making devices on on blackbirds, you may also disturb those bluebirds. Mm-hmm. So you can try that if you want. There are some blackbird traps that you can use, where you can trap them and either relocate them, or you can trap them and you are legal to euthanize those blackbirds. You can hunt the blackbirds if you want at the time that damage is occurring, mm-hmm. so to speak. So there are some things that you can do out there with the bluebirds and the blackbirds, but it's problematic. Mm-hmm. Let's say that.
And actually, on the break, we were talking about, David, you said that you saw red-winged blackbirds that were harassing Sandhill Crane and her colt. So, you know, it's kind of that constant, you know, different species parents trying to protect their own young.
That's exactly right. And every species, you know, has that strong desire to breed and to protect their young and perpetuate the species. And so, especially during nesting season, some problems that you might be able to take care of during non-nesting season become a little bit more thorny to take care of during nesting season, because the birds are so much more
protective
and loyal to
vigilant.
That area. Vigilant, yep.
Thanks for that call, Darren. And going back, we talked a lot about wildlife rehabilitation earlier, and Chris in Wisconsin Dells wonders, is there a listing, probably, you know, by county or something, of where to take wildlife, like injured animals?
And there is. And again, just to keep pointing people back to the source, but the Department of Natural Resources website, again, keyword search, Keep Wildlife Wild. And I'm sure that we'll get that up on Larry's Facebook
we'll
page,
that up, definitely.
Too. But once you get onto the Keep Wildlife Wild website, on the right-hand side, there is a link to the Rehabilitators directory. So those are licensed wildlife rehabilitators, and they are listed by county. So that will be very helpful. Just a note, each wildlife rehabilitator may specialize in specific animals. So if you have a bat situation, that you know, particular wildlife rehabilitator may not take bats. So sometimes it may involve a call to them to see who they might refer in that specific situation. So that will all be noted in the directory.
We had an earlier call about what might be emptying a hummingbird feeder, and Joan posted a photo on the Facebook page by hummingbird feeder at 3 p.m. at the Mississippi River, and there is, just like you said, David, a raccoon happily slurping.
It is now a raccoon feeder.
There is now a raccoon feeder slurping that sweet nectar. Speaking of hummingbirds, a caller wondered, can hummingbirds eat mosquitoes? If so, maybe they should be our state bird.
You know, hummingbirds will eat insects. If you hang a mesh bag, like what oranges would come in or onions, with bananas, whether they're peeled or not, and as they start to, rot, it'll attract insects, and the hummingbirds will come and pick the insects off of them. So they certainly eat insects. They probably don't eat mosquitoes as much as we may have, may want them to. But
not as much as our bats do.
Correct.
Certainly our bats
help
us out.
Or swifts or martens.
You know, I'm a big bat fan, so I always have comments on that. Well, David, last time you and Jamie were on, we talked about the Fox family living on the UW-Madison campus, and I know people are interested in whether there's an update on that.
Yep. So, the Foxes are doing well. They are the kits are growing rapidly and are expanding their range about where they're going and hunting with the mom and things like that. And I guess maybe 3 weeks or so ago, we got a call from somebody over in Soil Sciences, a building here on campus, and they said that a fox had fallen into a window well. It was about 4 feet deep. So a colleague and I and the pest control expert on campus, we ran over there and fished the kit out with a big kind of long-handled musky net and let the kit go and then put the grate back on the window well. And then, unfortunately, last Monday, I got a call over by the natatorium here on the west side of campus by Lake Monona that one of the kits got killed by a car. And sure enough.
Which happened to the father, too.
Yeah, right? And that's what happened to the father that we had radio collared. And that is going to be probably the prime factor for mortality for the kits, especially as they start ranging further and further, that they're going to encounter more roads and things like that. But we also had a colleague stopped in yesterday and said that on Sunday, he and his partner were walking along campus and saw a fox and was just sitting there in the grass, and they got within about 3 feet of the fox, and the fox didn't even seem to be bothered by it.
Wow. So good to get a follow-up sometime on those
stories.
Joan, who posted the picture of the raccoon drinking from the hummingbird nest, also posted a picture of, I believe, a big snapping turtle.
Yep, that's correct.
And she says, guarding him as he slowly crosses the road, and that was in La Crosse. And we did talk quite a bit with Scott Craven a couple weeks ago about that turtles are on the
move. Yeah, it's prime turtle season, and I guess a real quick point here is as they're crossing roads, they are moving from wetland areas to upland areas to lay their eggs and then returning. So depending on what part of that process they're in, whatever way they are heading, let them head that way.
That was one of the important points is don't take them back.
That's right.
And if you can safely help them across the road by pulling over and helping them across, great. But if it's a really busy interstate, obviously our safety comes first.
And if it's a big snapping turtle, do be careful because they're quicker than they look, and they can inflict a very painful bite.
All right. Let's go back to the phones and Tom in Morris, Illinois. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
I got a question about population of cougars in Wisconsin. I was up there riding a dirt bike, and the guy that does a lot of bear hunting said that the DNR does not want to confirm a population of cougars in Wisconsin.
All right. Jamie, did you want to handle
that? Yeah, I'd be happy to. So for the last, I would say 5 to 7 years now, the state has confirmed the presence of mountain lions or cougars in the state. Prior to that, there were certainly reports coming in from the public, but they were not able to confirm it through DNA evidence. So whether that be droppings or feces, blood, hair, they just did not have unequivocal evidence that cougars existed. We do have that now. And again, as I said, as of the last 5 to 7 years, a minimum of 6 individual cougars, last I've heard, individual animals have been documented in the state. And the way they get documented most of the time is from the general public that has trail cameras, and they come across on the trail camera. And you see a subsequent number of trail camera reports, and you can almost track them as they move through the state. What we know at this point is all of the cougars that have been here have been male. So in the definition of the term population, we don't have a population because we don't have the breeding females.
Right.
So we have individuals that have kind of moved this way on exploratory movements. All of them have the genetic makeup. They've been tracked back to the South Dakota Black Hills population. So more than likely, these are young males that are looking to disperse and establish their own territory, and they continue to move because they're not encountering those females. So those reports do come up from time to time. They are certainly, you know, have been here and will probably continue to be here. But
And I think the best part of those cougar stories that have come into Wisconsin is the one that unfortunately had ended with a vehicle, he got killed by a vehicle, but he had moved over 1,000 miles from South Dakota and it got killed about 30 miles from the Atlantic Ocean in Connecticut.
Right.
And it was amazing.
That's incredible.
Yeah,
when
it
you
really
think
is.
About that.
Yeah, and Tom, actually, the first individual I believe that was documented in Wisconsin moved through and went southeast Wisconsin into Chicago, and
that's
the Chicago Police Department shot it.
Yep,
so,
in a forest preserve in Chicago, inside the city limits of Chicago.
Wow. So. Well, thanks for that call, Tom. And caller Pedro in Fond du Lac says his grandma put Vaseline on feeder poles to keep chipmunks off feeders, and it works like a charm.
Yeah, you can. There's both predator guards, which are like a conical-shaped guard that affix to them. The only caution on using Vaseline, when you get up towards the top of the feeder is that it can get onto the feathers of birds. You know, on the pole, it's probably not a concern, as he mentioned. But, you know, as far as doing that up towards where the feed is, that can be an issue for birds or something to think about.
Yeah. And the only other thing I'll say is chipmunks obviously are a hibernatory species, so we don't see them very often in the winter. But as it starts getting colder, those chipmunks need that fur to stay warm, and that Vaseline will also mat the fur, and sometimes that will prevent them from the necessary thermal cover they need.
They lose some of that insulation.
That's right. So just be careful about that.
Sometimes sheet metal wrapped around the pole, you know, things like that can do the same thing.
Let's go to Richard in Huntley, Illinois. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm a gardener, a farmer gardener, and my gardens are fenced, but I have this year a lot of mature rabbits all over, and I know they nest all over, and I'm using, have a heart traps, but they don't want to eat my spinach or my lettuce. So I'm wondering what would be a good food to put in there to maybe attract them into these cages.
All right. David, what would you use to bait those rabbits?
Well, Richard, I'm going to give you another option aside from trapping it, and I think this is the easiest rabbit deterrent, and that's to put some fencing up around your gardens that you're trying to protect. And with rabbits, it doesn't take much. As a matter of fact, you could just maybe put a 2-foot-high fence or 2-foot-tall fence up, and it can be anything like chicken wire, or it could be even that erosion control black sediment control fencing that you see at construction sites, something like that. Whatever is aesthetically pleasing to you. And, you know, especially with chicken wire on lush gardens, that chicken wire kind of blends into the vegetation. You really don't even see it. And the only thing you want to do is make sure that you stake the bottom of the fencing down. Rabbits are not strong diggers, but in loose organic soil, they can certainly move enough soil away that they can get underneath the bottom of that fence. And I think that's a lot easier to do than trapping them and having to maintain a trapping program.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Richard. And before we run out of time, I know that there's an interesting new book out that's available as a free download from the DNR website. It's called The Gamekeepers, Wisconsin Wildlife Conservation from WCD to CWD. And we are planning on having author David Jeston on the show to discuss it. But would you like to comment, David, about why this is an important publication, or Jamie?
Sure, I can comment on it. So, first of all, the WCD is the Wisconsin Conservation Department. So from the beginning of the Wisconsin Conservation Department leading to the CWD, chronic wasting disease.
Right.
So the book basically covers the history of the development of the wildlife profession in our state and how game management as a science has evolved since 1832. It covers the creation of the DNR, and it also has, Dave did a really great job interviewing many of the gamekeepers, those that, you know, protected and managed wildlife during that time. And it's really, there's a colorful history of wildlife professionals covered within the book. It is by no means a quick read. It is a historical document.
It is really,
but it is just
jam-packed.
Rich with history. And to his credit, I mean, Dave was born and raised in Wisconsin and worked for the state in a number of different positions. And once he retired, he did research for over 2 years, both interviewing employees and, you know, just diving through the archives. And 7 years later, the book kind of emerged. So we are grateful for him as a historian.
It really
to put
is
together.
A huge amount of work that went into it. And we do have a link up on the Facebook page so people can download that. But as I said, we plan to have Dave on to talk about it. But I wanted to make sure we got to mention that.
Good. Thank you for doing that.
Let's go back to the phones and Jay in Washburn. Hi, Jay.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I want to back to a quick question on black flies again. I've seen mosquitoes, adult mosquitoes, overwinter under litter and cover. And I'm wondering if black flies can actually overwinter, like in leaf litter or some sort of cover.
I'm wondering if that's a question for Phil Pelletier.
Yeah, Phil's still working. Yes. That would be a good one to ask him.
I think he might be on next week. If not, he's going to be on soon.
Okay.
So we'll definitely ask him about that. And so let's go back to the phones. I promise, Jay, we'll get you an answer, just not today. let's go back and Jocelyn in Sheboygan. Hi, Jocelyn.
Hi. I was just wondering, some time ago, a little fawn was rescued by a humane society up north somewhere. I can't remember the name of the humane society. And then the DNR got involved, and they took that little fawn and ended up killing it, which I thought was so horrific. And I don't know, I heard one word that they were afraid of disease.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just think that was... a terrible thing.
Sure. We're getting a little short on time here, Jocelyn, so let me let Jamie comment on that.
Yeah, Jocelyn, I can give you a really quick synopsis there, but deer are kind of unique in that we do have chronic wasting disease in our state, which is a always fatal neurological disease that impacts deer. There's over 30 counties where there are infected either wild deer or captive deer. So it is of large concern from the overall health of our deer population. And as with the captive wildlife laws, whether it's a deer or any other animal, an individual cannot have that animal unless they are a wildlife rehabilitator, and it needs to be, you know, rehabilitated with, you know, release in mind or for educational purposes. And in case of deer, they're unique with some of these disease risks and concerns. So unfortunately, it becomes a case where they can't be released into the wild because of some of these threats for mm-hmm. disease and the overall population in mind. And if you want to look into that, that policy again is on that Keeping Wildlife Wild. There's the deer policy is on there.
And just a follow-up to that with the Keeping Wildlife Wild, we will have a link to that up on the Facebook page, along with there is a link to the Gamekeepers book download that people can find there, and some really great photos that have been posted today. We had a call that we're not going to be able to get to, and also an email wondering about moose population in Wisconsin and what's going on in Minnesota. We did a 45-minute segment on that moose issue, I want to say about maybe a couple months ago. I'll repost that on the Facebook page so people can listen to that. It was a couple of people working on that Minnesota moose population.
That'd be great. And I'm not sure they found anything yet because they just started the research.
Right.
And
they
so
had
early.
some preliminary things, but it's definitely an ongoing concern. Well, again, the time just flew by as it often does. David Drake, wildlife specialist with UW Extension, associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And Jamie, always a pleasure to have you with us, wildlife outreach specialist in forest and wildlife ecology also.
Thanks again for having us back.
It's always a lot of fun, and I certainly always learn a lot when we have you on. Well, tomorrow at 11, we are going to learn about stucco because Ken Adams and John Freiberger will be here to talk about that home exterior. They'll also answer your home repair and improvement questions as well. Thanks to Jason Butler for his on-air production today. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller. I hope you'll stay tuned to the Ideas Network.